Welcome to In the Studio with a 21st Century Perspective on History's Greatest Rock Album.
Excuse me.
You're welcome.
Guitar up.
One,
turn
two,
guitar three.
I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, it's the anniversary since Motley Crue made a house call with the number one album in America, Dr. Feelgood.
You know, we were operating like a punk band. We were completely out of control. And I think we always drank, did drugs, did girls, did tours, wrote lyrics, said things, did interviews, dressed certain ways, all because we were really, we had good intentions. I just think this band is so funny. It's like if there's a pile of dog shit, this band's going to step in. Hey, this is Nikki Sixx of Motley Crue in the studio with Motley Crue's Greatest Hits.
Watching and listening to Motley Crue rock the house in tight formation on their farewell tour, it's easy to forget how grunge checkmated all of the pop metal bands of the 80s. How Motley Crue chucked their only lead singer, frontman Vince Neil, within a year of winning the Rolling Stone magazine readers' poll as best metal band. How Tommy Lee had gone to jail, and how his replacement on drums, Randy Castillo, had died of cancer, just like Vince Neil's little daughter. Yet here they are on the anniversary of having the number one selling album in America, Dr. Feelgood. Motley Crue songwriter and bass player Nikki Sixx is proud that Motley Crue transcended the pop metal forest of the late 80s hair bands and learned from the best.
You know, there's a few bands that are perfect. The Stones are perfect. You know, I think Aerosmith is perfect. Van Halen is perfect. Kiss is perfect. I think they are, because this is what I do. I sit there and go, if I want to create a band and I want the whole world to get it, what do I want? And I want diverse personalities. I want songs. I want musicianship. I want snottiness. I want a certain swagger. And you look at bands like Kiss and you go, man, even though that was fabricated, you know, the music was still real. And, you know, as fabricated as, you know, the Stones were in 1976 with Mick Jagger in his velvet jumpsuit that said Mick and Rhinestones on it, as fabricated as Nikki Sixx wearing, you know, 8-inch platforms and football stripes under his eyes, you know, it's cartoon characters is what we are. And when you see it like that, you go, that's either perfect or it isn't perfect. I mean, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young as a perfect band. I think Motley Crue, you know, has been one of those bands. It's perfect. There's nothing that we didn't need any other elements. It was exactly what it needed to be for the time. You know, we got the Doors, we got Zeppelin, and then, you know, it's amazing when it hits. I mean, look at Guns N' Roses. I mean, that first record, that was a perfect band. And what happens after that? You know, that's the trick. That's the hat trick.
We'll be right back. the title song to Motley Crue's 1989 Dr. Feelgood album. At the very close of the decade, Western concepts like freedom, human rights, and democracy were sprouting through the seams of the Iron Curtain in the Soviet bloc countries. In August 1989, Motley Crue was one of several bands allowed to travel to the Moscow Music Peace Festival. Here's Motley Crue lead singer Vince Neil.
It was Lenin Stadium. It's what they built it for the Moscow Olympics. So when they had the Olympics over there, so wow. It was huge, huge place.
I mean, how many does it hold?
It held 100,000. It was a lot of people.
And it was full.
It was full both nights.
Two nights.
2 days.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, we did two shows, the same show.
You remember when this was first presented to you? What did you think?
Actually, I didn't think it was going to happen.
And why?
You know, well, because I mean, trying to get this many rock and roll bands over to Russia, and like where metal music anyway is like the devil's music and all that, you know,
it's kind of like certain parts of America.
So, you know, people like Billy Joel go over there and it's cool, but not, you know, not Motley Crue. I mean. Well, you can't really make any money over there anyway.
Why?
You can't take rubles out of the country. That's why this charity thing worked, because all the money that was generated through ticket sales and merchandising, T-shirts sold at the gig, all went to a foundation set up for the Soviet Union.
Do they have a lot of the same problems that we have, with drugs and alcohol and stuff like that in the Soviet Union too?
Dude, where do you think they make vodka?
That's right.
Stoli, yeah.
Oh,
worth the wait since they made history at the Moscow Music Peace Festival in the former Soviet Union. That's Motley Crue, recorded live from Lenin Stadium, August 12th and 13th, 1989. Vince Neil of Motley Crue describes the actual Moscow 1989 stadium concerts.
Well, you know, the Soviet Union is like America was in like the 1930s.
The 30s?
Yeah, that's exactly how it was.
I mean, give me some examples, like...
Like the hotels, for instance, like the beds, they don't have mattresses, they just have...
What?
They just have, like pads with stuffing in them, and the beds are, like, 5 feet long, you know? I mean, it's really strange, and, like, we were, like, a real nice hotel,
and it was a nice hotel?
It was kind of like The Shining. You know, it's like really weird. Yeah,
a giant place, and basically
the hotel had like 13,000 rooms in it.
What?
Like yeah, it was huge. I mean, it looked like a giant castle. It was really. I mean, the architecture in Moscow is really cool, but you know, that's it. I mean, if you like to look at buildings, I mean, that's it because there's nothing inside the buildings. But see, a lot of the places only take American money. Because rubles aren't really worth anything, and the Russian people only have rubles, so they can't buy like the cool stuff.
Very strange. Very strange. Did you find anything there that you would want to bring back? As far, I mean, was there anything? Nothing really.
Nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing. There was nothing to buy. I mean, you could buy like the little dolls, you know, Russian dolls or something. You know, I mean, that was it. We went into the mall, like their equivalent to like a mall.
Yeah.
And all they pretty much sold was like stuff to make your own clothes with, you know, like material.
Wow.
And they had a record store, which was really funny because I went in there and there were some Rolling Stone records.
Really?
Yeah, being displayed. Yeah, that was really cool, except for I took a Rolling Stone album out and I turned it around to see what songs were on it. And there was not one Rolling Stone song on the album.
What?
But they were on the cover.
What?
So, yeah. Now, that's a great way to sell a record.
We'll be right back.
That'll get the blood flowing. That's the rollicking Kickstart My Heart from Motley Crue's 1989 album Dr. Feelgood with Mick Mars on guitar talk box. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Nikki Sixx and Vince Neil in the studio for their number one seller, Dr. Feelgood.
This is Nikki Sixx in the studio for Dr. Feelgood.
Motley Crue songwriter, bass player Nikki Sixx remembers Motley Crue hijacking elevators in record company buildings, not unlike an Olympic sport.
You know, we would move furniture into the elevator too, and we would like hang out in the elevator, and people would be going up and down. It'd be like 4 o'clock in the morning, and some business guys coming in, and we'd be sitting there. We'd have, you know, it nice and vibed out. We'd cover the lights in some kind of material or something, and you'd be in there partying. You know, you become sort of this person that goes, I wonder what it would be like to, you know, drive a Bentley into a swimming pool. I can't do that now. You know, but it's amazing to me. You know, you start to get the realities of stuff, and you know, then as you get farther into it, you start going like, so if we have 100 things that blow up every night, we're going to go home with no money. And if we have 75 things that blow up every night, we're going to go home with a little bit of money. At one point in your career, you go, I don't care. Then later, you know, you go, wow, man, the Dr. Feelgood tour at the time, 1989, $325,000 a week to break even. So we're, you know, $1.2 million a month, and we're gone for 15 months. So, you know, we spent about $20 million just entertaining. So anything after that was ours. And, you know, that's like part of the thing where you go, wow, man, you need a better business plan. What's your exit strategy? Pee in the corner and blow everything up.
great slide guitar from Mick Mars on Motley Crue's number 8 hit, Without You, written by Nikki Sixx on the number 1 seller, Dr. Feelgood. The 1987 Girls, Girls, Girls album by Motley Crue went to number 2, selling over 4 million copies, so the subsequent 100-city tour was a nearly sold-out advance success. Except, Motley Crue never finished the European leg. Here's Nikki Sixx.
You know, we were operating like a punk band. We were completely out of control. I know that there was a time in there when it was a blur, a complete blur of drug addiction. I'm so thankful that we didn't have the marketing and the ability to get information across the globe that we have now, because if I had been in my house with such a huge heroin and cocaine problem that I was on the verge of death, paranoia and insanity, and I had a computer, who knows what would have happened. And also that if other people could have visited me, that did visit me, and could have gone done more than go to the cat house on Thursday night and go, man, I was at Nikki's house. He's f***ed up. You post that on the internet, and it's worldwide in newspapers, on radio shows, you know. So in a sense, you're right. The world didn't know what was really going on. And I wasn't even aware that the world was going on. I was just doing what I do. And there's that kind of thing again, you know, where you just doing what you do, and oh, yeah, I'm in a band. Yeah, you know, from time to time, I've always forgot I was in a band. I always forget that. I think I'm just like, you know, sometimes I want to be Hunter S. Thompson or William Burroughs or something, and I get like woke up, jolted with like, you know, you guys got to go do a tour, and I'm like, oh yeah, you know. And as the years, those years were especially like that, and the band didn't hang out. Everybody was on different wavelengths. Tommy had met Heather Locklear, so he was in, like, you know, a whole different realm. I'm like down the street, you know, in the gutter with all the junkies, and he's up the street in the mansion with all the actors and movie stars. Mick is a recluse, and Vince, you know, kind of was like, he loves strip clubs. That's his thing. Strip clubs and hanging out. Vince has never changed. I think that we were just really became four different people, but it came across in the music, you know, that way too. And you go back to Girls, Girls, Girls. I remember being in the studio, not showing up for days at a time. And then when I would show up in the studio, everyone would be completely wasted, or I'd be the bad guy. I'd have syringes in my cowboy boots, and I'd pull them out and shoot up in the bathroom so no one could look. And in the mornings, I'd have to go to methadone clinics, you know, just so I could not shoot up so much during the day so I wouldn't get sick. And, you know, extreme alcoholism. You know, there's a lot of talk of drugs and stuff, but the thing is, Motley Crue is an extremely hard drinking band. You know, when you drink as hard as we drank, we, you know, tend to have a lot of reckless things that happen along with it. So, you know, it was fun. I think we always drank, did drugs, did girls, did tours, wrote lyrics, said things, did interviews, dressed certain ways, all because we were really, we had good intentions. I just think this band is so funny. It's like, if there's a pile of dog shit, this band's going to step in it. She changed her name.
Motley Crue's Same Old Situation from 1989's Dr. Feelgood album. Up next, the doctor makes a house call on the House of Crue, and later, Motley Crue shows Comrade Lennon how to rock down the Iron Curtain. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, with Nikki Sixx and Vince Neil in the studio for the anniversary of their 6 million seller, Dr. Feelgood.
This is Nikki Sixx in the studio for Dr. Feelgood.
Thanks, Nikki. I'm Redbeard. Years after kicking heroin, you can still clearly hear the gravity of the battle in the voice of Motley Crue's Nikki Sixx.
To be perfectly honest with you, I was really uncomfortable in my skin at that time. I was just figuring, I was socially inept human being. I had no social skills. My whole life had been, my social skills had been based around some kind of a buzz. So to be in this thrown into a jet with all these other people who I, either knew or didn't know or kind of knew, but they were all partying their asses off and I was dry. That's what I remember about the trip over. Then getting there, it was, I and I'm sure the guys in the band always take our performances very seriously. Once you hit the stage, you're back to that gang again. Even in the worst of times, if we were totally spread apart and we were not close, when that band hits the stage, we look at each other and we're like, we are going to do some damage. And we walk off the stage and the damage has been done to the band. So that's what we've wrestled with for years, is and not unlike the Eagles or, many other bands. So you go there. You're uncomfortable in your skin, speaking for myself only. You do your show and you leave. And I remember leaving and feeling, something was about to happen. I think I remember we flew to New York. We took our own plane back. We got in a fight with the management. We were lied to. We felt like we'd been taken advantage of. Every review, everything was something I'd never seen before. This is the greatest record. This is the greatest band. This is number one. This is number two. This is number three. This is this. This is this. Blah, blah, blah. Phone call. Hey, man, tour's sold out. Hey. Unbelievable. Almost unsettling. Well, we've been a punk band for so long. We've just been like, crash and burn and, a lot has been said about that, and also a lot has been said about, there is some form of genius behind Motley Crue, and a lot of people have pointed at me at saying, he really knew. Well, I agree, in the early days, I had a vision, but there is a few years there where I didn't have a vision. I couldn't see straight. We were just flying by the seat of our pants, And, karmically or, whatever it is, we were allowed to stay in the game. And then we got clean and we made a record that it was unbelievable. And I think we still were like, we're still the underbelly. We're just blah, blah, blah. We're just a rock and roll band. No one really takes us seriously. No, we don't really care if you do or don't. You know what I mean? And then all of a sudden, there it is. It just happened. On top of everything and everybody, and everyone's looking, and everything you touch turns to platinum. That's for a guy like me who grew up wanting to be William Burroughs, as a writer, or a guy like me who thought, Lou Reed and Ian Hunter are my, they're my Bob Dylans. That's an uncomfortable place to be. It was very hard for me to accept a home and a wife and children and friends, the phone that doesn't ring after 9 o'clock at night, used to wake up at 9 o'clock at night. So that was an interesting period for me as a human being. I mean, it's so wonderful, but at the same time, I remember not being very comfortable in my skin about a lot of stuff and being pissed. I was pissed because it was working.
What time? turn the page.
Dr. Feelgood album was working overtime. Number 4 in the UK, a bona fide number 1 top seller in America. At last count, passed 6 million copies sold. In 1991, Motley Crue was voted the top heavy metal band in the Rolling Stone magazine readers' poll. But there was terror in Tinseltown internally, and Vince Neil was estranged from Motley Crue for 5 years before the original lineup of Tommy Lee, Nikki Sixx, Mick Mars, and Neil would reunite. I asked Mick Mars and Vince Neil what they learned from the period apart.
You can't just stay the same, and that's what we've always done, was always evolve. You know, I mean, Feel Good was different than Girls, 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 and that was way different than Theater of Pain, which was different than
Much
Shout at the Devil.
And,
you know, we're always trying to improve ourselves and better ourselves. And
yeah. We make great music together. It's the four of us have a certain charisma about, you know, the combination of us four, and it's bizarre. It's hard to explain, but it's like we just definitely... It's great.
It's choice.
That's what it is.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
I'm not trying to get all analytical or anything, but it's, I don't know, it's just a very powerful feeling for me.
I think we really realize we screwed up.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, let's just be honest here.
We are being honest.
You know, I mean, we make really good music when we're apart, but, you know, we make great music when we're together. It's just the four of us, we're like a machine, you know, and it just works really well when all the parts are there. And it'll still run when, you know, when one wheel's off, but it'll run a lot better with all four.
And for the last word on genuine hard rock versus hair bands, Nikki Sixx cautioned fans to be discerning. Otherwise, Nikki contends, you risk buying into a contrivance designed simply to take your money.
Metallica, I think they meant it. You know, I think, you know, a lot of the metal bands after that, they were, you know, the equivalent of, I don't know, D4, the Dotsons. And, you know, you look at Pearl Jam and you go, they meant it. And then there's all those bands. And it's hard, man. It's hard to pick which ones are real, you know. If you're just a consumer and you're just a guy who works 9 to 5 and maybe you have a wife and a kid and, you know, you only get to go to your record store like once or twice a month and you go in there and you hear these songs on the radio and you go, well, it kind of reminds me of that Pearl Jam thing, or it kind of reminds me of that crew type thing. It's because somebody went out and said, this is the working model for what you have to sound like to be successful right now. And that part of the industry has always frustrated me. I mean, I'm not alone in the frustration there. You know, and then you become kind of bitter and snide. And I'm definitely not bitter or snide, but I like to lay the truth out there, especially for listeners when they can listen to it and go, oh, man, you know, I never really saw what was happening to me. And there was the, I'm telling you, there's the period coming out of the cocoon that is uncomfortable. And it wasn't for Tommy. Tommy was like, yeah, man, I'm married to Heather Locklear. I got a number one album. That's great. You know, Tommy was always so fun. The funnest guy in the world. I mean, Tommy, just everybody loved Tommy. Tommy is a big kid. Great. Vince, you know, just, you know, the girls. He loved women. You know, Mick, reclusive, but happy, you know, feeling content, feeling like, you know, I showed them, you know, and feeling pretty proud. And me feeling like, oh my God, what is going on? Was an interesting time for me. I mean, there was a time after that when I became like, wow, I feel kind of like a human being. I've talked with my wife and I said, you know, my whole life I felt like an alien. And she's like, you know, what do you mean? I was alone in a room full of people for so long. My head wouldn't stop. My brain wouldn't stop working. Everything was too information. It was just like overwhelming on a, you know, me and Mick have talked about it. It's like being on an acid trip for 20 years. And I kind of felt like I came down. Kind of felt like I was coming down a little bit and I could breathe a little bit. I could be like, wow, so this is life. This is what it's like to watch Monday Night Football. Without a syringe in your arm. Wow, this is interesting. But whatever it is, I'm driven. Remember when I told you I was in Martinique and I got off the plane and I came in and into the airport and a guy says, your singer's dead? It was like that, getting off the plane from Russia and people going, your album's number one. I mean, I was in Russia with all these messed up, dysfunctional motherfuckers and being lied to by management, and I was in this depressed place and, you know, just kind of in that muck, and landing in New York City and finding out that you're the king and the top of your game.
Yeah! I'm hungry, high, hungry.
I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests Nikki Sixx, Vince Neil, and Bob Deal, better known as Mick Mars. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2014, all rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. And visit inthestudio.net.